Good evening, everyone. Virtual audience for joining us. Thank you, CJ, for coming to see us again.
My pleasure.
Thank all of you. We have been together, CJ and Poison Pen and I, from his very first book, every single book, except for we had to do one or so by COVID.
Right. Yeah, we did. Well, I came down. We just didn't have an event.
No, you came down to sign the book. It was too many books to ship to him in rural Wyoming, so he didn't come and see us. But anyway, we have a long history, and I thought we might talk about that a little bit, because the truth is, in a new thriller, if we tell you very much about the book, there's hardly going to be any point you're going home to read it, right? Because we will have completely ruined it. And so why don't we talk for a moment? You've had also the same editor throughout your career, who's a friend of mine.
Right. I've been lucky enough to have an editor named Neil Nyman, who is kind of a legendary editor in New York. He's also the editor, currently still the editor of John Sanford as well. And when Neil retired from Putnam, he was the editor-in-chief, wasn't he?
Yeah.
That was his title. And when he retired, part of his retirement package was he said he wanted to continue editing John Sanford and I. So it's great. I'm a fan of John Sanford, and he reads my books too. And Neil's still at it. In fact, I just got an email from him just before you picked me up. He's chatting a lot more these days, but he lost his wife recently, and they were quite an item. But he seems to be doing okay. He's the best editor I've ever had.
I told CJ that I'd really like to get Neil to come next time. It'd be fun for you to listen to CJ and his editor talk to each other. So we'll see what we can do. And since you mentioned John Sanford gratuitously, I will say hilariously that John Sanford's book publishes on April 9th, but he overlooked that and booked a vacation to Hawaii. So he's going to fly in earlier in April and sign all the books, and then he's going to come back on April 17th to do the actual event, because we are the only event that he does. I think, only John would actually do that.
Yes,
right?
Sure.
I know.
Sounds like
it. Yep. So, CJ lives. I'm holding in my hand here a very nice article in the New York Times Book Review that came out last Sunday about CJ. And part of it says, Boxes at Home is at home on the bestseller list, as he is on the range, and his popularity affords him a level of comfort with subjects other authors might avoid. My subject matter is a lot of the time a controversial issue in the West about resources and the environment and energy, Box said, but there's lots of different points of view and I like to cover them all. And one of the things we're really going to talk about tonight is bears, particularly grizzly bears. But the other point is that CJ lives, and I'm quoting again, on a 320-acre ranch in Wyoming, where he writes two mystery series plus the occasional standalone from an office atop his barn, where I have been, and which has, I have to say, expansive views. But if I remember right, you've got your desk situated, so you're not enjoying the expansive view.
Yes, when I had the office built on top of the barn, I learned something previously when I had an office in a cabin with a beautiful view of a river, encampment river. And I would be working away, and I'd look out the window, and I'd see the fish were rising. So that would wreck the day. I'd grab my fly rod and I wouldn't get any work done. So when we had this office built, I said, I want the window high enough that I can't see outside unless I stand up. And it helps.
Right. And there are actual horses underneath. Mm-hmm. So, CJ's wife, Lori, is really looking after the horses.
That's right.
So when my husband and I went to visit CJ, he was out on his shooting range when we got there. And okay, you can describe my attempt to shoot. It was pathetic.
You did all right. I think there's a lot of, especially a lot of writers out there who would love to see Barbara Peters with a handgun. and I was able to make that come to life. You did actually quite well. I think the first time you'd ever shot one, right?
Well, the recoil nearly killed me. I have no idea. Yeah. Yes, in point of fact.
You did well.
And then my husband surprised me because it turned out he was actually able to do a little skeet shooting, which, was a new facet. So it was a revelatory day all the way around.
We do a lot of shooting.
You do. The other great thing that happened, and I put it on Instagram, but I don't know if anybody could find it anymore, the only tornado I have ever seen appeared while we were at CJ's, and we all went out on the balcony and watched it right across the road, remember,
yep.
traveling along.
The only tornado we have ever seen where I live was at the same time that Barbara was visiting, so you can draw your own conclusions.
Very true. Well, anyway, it's wonderful fishing country where CJ lives, but what we're going to talk about tonight, and by the way, I meant to say that I do think it's a great compliment to your success and your skill that the New York Times has spent an entire column not writing about the book, but just writing about you.
I was kind of surprised myself. I just expected a hit job of some kind, and it was really quite nice, and I thought very fair.
It does say, I will mention this, of course, Box is well aware that he can't make every reader happy. So that's not going to be any of you, right? But yeah. Just in case. So there are people who love wolves so much, and if a wolf is mentioned in a book as not being a noble heavenly creature, they're upset with me. But I'm going to ask the same question. How do you think people are going to feel about grizzly bears after they read this book?
Well, I hope that the book is not intended to scare people about grizzly bears or attempted, you know, it's not an attempt to suggest that they should be eradicated, because they are part of the West, they are part of the, especially the Yellowstone ecosystem. They're, you know, they live there, they belong there, they've been there forever, they weren't introduced by well-meaning legislation. They're also, you know, up and down the spine of the Rocky Mountains and in Glacier Park and throughout Montana. But there's no doubt in the last few years that there have been more what the wildlife officials call grizzly and human encounters than ever before. And in fact, two falls ago, there were three fatalities in the same fall. Two elk hunters and then an elk hunting guide. And the attacks, two of them would be considered justified in a way, because the hunters inadvertently cross paths with the grizzly between a sow and a cubs, and when that happens, that happens. That's weird behavior. But in one case, in particular, a sow grizzly bear and her mature yearling cub, male, charged out of the trees at an elk hunting guide and the elk they had just killed, and we just ran straight towards them and never stopped. No bluff charges, anything. Went after the guy, killed him on the spot. The client was able to run away, and the bears, that's not normal bear behavior, but that's what happened. And the predator attack team, which is a real thing in Wyoming, it's almost like a SWAT team for large carnivores. They arrived by helicopter at the scene of the death, and the two bears were still there, standing over the top of the body. Not eating it, not catching it, hiding it away, standing as if they were guarding it. And the bears actually attacked the helicopter as it was landing. And they were able to, over 2 days, kill those two bears who had never been identified before, mark, collar, anything. No one knew about these bears. And the behavior was so homicidal and so scary and so different that the predator attack team thought maybe the mama bear had a brain tumor or something, made her act like this. So they cut her head off, and they put it in the helicopter, and on their way back to the base, the pilot could hardly fly the helicopter because the bear spray that was embedded in the head of that bear was so strong that it was out through the entire helicopter, which meant the guy did everything he was supposed to. He sprayed the bear with bear spray as it was coming. Didn't deter the bear one bit. The bear continued. In fact, it actually bit a hole in the bear spray can, and it was covered, but stayed there the whole time. So that kind of weird behavior doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's really scary.
So how fast can a grizzly run?
They can run 45 miles an hour at a sprint. They can outrun any horse, any man, certainly. They can't do that in a sustained way, you know, but in a sprint, they're incredibly fast, so like a freight train. And often what they do is what they call a bluff charge, where they run within 10 feet of you and stop. you know, and if you haven't had a heart attack, then you have to decide whether there's two things that the experts tell you. One is to make as much noise as possible and jump around. The other is to roll into a fetal position on the ground and not move. So you have to make a decision at that moment, which one do I do? And I don't know which one is correct.
Well, the one that works.
Whatever.
The one that works is correct. So I mentioned that because when we were in Wyoming en route to see CJ, we left Jackson and went up into South Yellowstone. And there was a sow with two cubs. And they were in a field and near a parking lot. And people were getting out of their cars and strolling on over, you know, to do this. And I wonder to what degree by now with, you know, Instagram, AI, all the rest of it, whether people think they're really at the zoo rather than, you know, in a dangerous situation. And I will underline that by saying that some years ago, we were on a safari in South Africa, and the guide that picked us up after we, you know, seen our five big animals and all the rest of it, was driving us to Johannesburg to take Ropa's Rail back to Cape Town. And we passed through a village, and he said, you might think, he said, that the fences and all the rest of it are here to protect the people from the animals. But he said, that is not the case. They are now here to protect the animals from the people. And an elephant apparently had managed to break his way through the fence and walk towards the village, and by the time the rangers got there, there was nothing left of the elephant. I mean, nothing. So, you know, I think that's true. As humans, you know, it's a really tough thing to decide whether, how humans and animals, especially, you know, large carnivores, although the elephant wasn't, are to interact.
Mm-hmm. It is, and some of the, I think when I was doing some of the research for this book, I talked to some of the medical personnel at the clinic in Yellowstone Park because they would often be involved in bear attacks and maulings or whatever. And, you know, there were sometimes just like a bear will just swipe at somebody, and they, those claws are huge, and they would stitch them up. And I said, and they said, but you know, the most common bear-related injury that they get in the clinic is when people buy the can of bear spray in the gift shop and apply it like suntan. Spray themselves down before they go out, and then of course they collapse in a heap and they're taken to the clinic.
I'm sure you could do something with that in the book.
I did mention that in this book.
Oh, yes.
It's too good.
No kidding, that really is. So the book opens with and you have a feeling you know what's coming, but tell us about Sheridan and this young man and who he is, because we open upon him fishing.
Sure, in the last book, Stormwatch, if you read that, you know that there's a young man named Clay Hutmacher Jr., the son of the ranch foreman. He's quite a hunky guy, and all the girls like him, but he had designs on Sheridan Pickett. She's not so sure herself, but he's pretty sure. And the book opens, and this is not giving, this is the first chapter and some of the description. He is fly fishing in the river with an engagement ring in his pocket that he's going to give to Sheridan that night. He thinks that'll be the right time. And while he's fishing, he hears what he thinks is a rock slide. He's in a steep canyon, standing knee deep in waders, and he thinks a rock slide is coming down the side of the hill through the trees. See trees shaking, some rocks coming down, and it's not obviously not a rock slide, it's a grizzly bear. And the bear hits the river and comes straight towards him. And he also thinks it might be a bluff charge, that there's not supposed to be grizzlies in this part of Wyoming anyway, but it doesn't stop. It swims at first and then it comes right at him, and the last thing he knows is that it's crunching his head under the water. And that is another. That's a real kind of creepy thing about all grizzly bear attacks is bears tend to go towards the face and head as initially when they do really attack. And almost everybody who's been killed or severely injured has these big holes in their skull. You know, that's why it's called 3-inch teeth. Their fangs can be that long.
Yeah, I think the title on the cover pretty much alerts you to the fact that at least one person is going to die by bear, right, in the book. And since Sharon wasn't entirely sure, what you're basically saying is that she won't, she'll be upset, she'll be sad, but not necessarily heartbroken.
Right, and she feels very guilty that she's not as heartbroken as everyone assumes she should be. It was pointed out to me a couple of days ago that, you know, as a me, father of three adult girls, that I probably thought, and maybe some of you people have thought, it wouldn't be so bad if that boy hanging around your daughter got chomped by a grizzly at just the right time. It's kind of wish fulfillment a little bit.
I must confess, I hadn't thought of that. I'm not a father of girls, so it just didn't really occur to me. But anyway, there, you know, people die in CJ's books, sometimes by human hands, sometimes by nature, and then, in this case, by animal. And there are always some really bad guys, too, which makes me wonder, is Wyoming actually populated by so many bad guys, or are you responsible for the uptick?
No, I think, you know, the actual population of the state is only 600,000. And if, you know, if my books were accurate, or if it actually happened, I think it would be down to about 400,000 now. So no, the body count is not as high as depicted.
So when the book opens, now that that's the opening scene and we all know that, what's Joe been up to since last time we saw him?
Just kind of doing his job. It's a year later, in the fall. Of course, because this fatality happens in Joe's district and happens to his potential, son-in-law, he gets involved in the investigation. The predator attack team arrives and they start to hunt this bear. I spent some time with members of the predator attack team, and they told me about their tactics and the things that they do and how they try to trap bears and put all that stuff in the book. But without giving too much away, these bear attacks start occurring around the state of Wyoming, hundreds of miles away from each other, and just a couple of days in between them. So the attack team doesn't know if it's one bear on a mission or a bunch of bears acting the same way at the same time. And what we'll find is that it's a little different than that.
Don't tell us that. But, you know, it's an interesting thought, whether sometimes things are just coincidence, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. They are. And just like, you know, the conditions were such 3 falls ago that there were 5 or 3 fatalities. This last fall, there were none. Because either the bears were not as active, or they weren't, they had enough food that they weren't aggressive, or whatever. But also, something that's really happened that I find interesting is that there's certain mountain ranges in the state of Wyoming where elk hunters just don't go anymore. Because they know that at the sound of a gunshot, some grizzly bears hear a dinner bell. And they just come. They run towards the shot. Because they're after the elk, not after the hunter necessarily. But in some cases, they're after the hunter too.
So one of the problems actually in the West is managing animal populations. So if the elk population goes up too high, that's bad news because there won't be enough food. Aren't grizzly bears part of sort of that, chain?
They are, but I think most people would say that wolves probably make more difference with the elk population than grizzly bears.
So are
grizzly bears are omnivores. Omnivores. They, they eat grubs, they eat white bark, pine beetle bark, all sorts of things. But wolves eat elk.
So before we go into the rest of the Pickett family, I also meant to say, in relation to Yellowstone, in case of any of you go there, the bison are almost as dangerous as the grizzly bears, and it's unbelievable how casual people are about the bison, which have recovered. They were almost extinct, and I think it was the Bronx Zoo, if I remember correctly, that had a breeding program that restored, the Phoenix Zoo did that for the Arabian oryx. We had a wonderful success here with the oryx. Pretty sure it was the Bronx Zoo that took the buffalo and sent him back out again. So now part of the question is, you know, how many can the land sustain human interaction? Mm-hmm. And the thing is that most often in an interaction that goes bad, the animal is the one that suffers. I mean, the person may be hurt, but generally that is a death sentence for an animal, even if it was not necessarily an intentional thing.
And that's a call that, like, the predator attack team needs to make. In most cases, the bears are trapped and relocated, not necessarily just immediately killed. But in the real severe ones where the attacks are unprovoked, what they do know about bear behavior is once bears are kind of hardwired to stay away from people, but once they cross that line, they're more likely to cross that line again. So they know they've got to take that bear out if it was an unprovoked attack.
Did any of you see the hilarious video about a family living up around Flagstaff, I think it was? Anyway, they had pizza delivered one night, and they had, you know, the camera, the door camera or whatever, and when they went out to get the pizza, it was gone. And that seemed really strange, so they went and looked at their camera, and some little black bear emerged from the woods, scarfed up the pizza, and off it went, you know. And I thought, you know, maybe we now have a pizza-loving bear.
That's right,
we'll
be back. Yeah.
It was great. So what's going on with the rest of the family? Let's start with Mary Beth, and then we'll move to Sheridan.
Sure, yeah. You know, in each book, different members of the family kind of step forward or step back. I like to do that. I like to have kind of collaborative in nature. Mary Beth is very involved in this case, like she always is. Sheridan really steps forward in this one in that she's given a job. If you've read the books, you know that she's working for Nate Romanowski in his bird abatement business, his falconry business, and as an apprentice. And for the first time, she's given a mission or a job on her own to travel from Wyoming to a place called Walden, Colorado, a place to, with her falcons, to get rid of starlings that are infesting a ranch. But the discovery she makes there is totally unexpected, I think, for most readers when they find out what that's all about and how that ties into the story.
Or so you hope, anyway.
I hope so, yeah.
And if you think that's an exaggeration, my husband and I, we were running Poison Pen Press, had an employee who took up falconry and left our employment to start her own pest agency using her falcons, and is hired by most of the resorts around the valley to fly the falcons and keep the pesky bird population down. And it's especially difficult where you have, you know, food eaten out in the open and mm-hmm. lots of, right? Anyway, so there are falcons, as we speak, here in Phoenix on the attack. Hopefully just for birds, but, you know, mm-hmm. that's what they are. So, you know, it is a business model because you set up, Nate and Sharon, you know, to actually have that kind of a business.
And I talk to people who have the falconry. Most of the falconers I know of who have those companies, they mainly do it, and they do it so that they can support their falconry habit. You know, because it pays them. If you're a dedicated master falconer, you have to pretty much devote your life to that, whether it's an art or a sport. So you need an outside income. So that's a way to generate that income. And so there's no misconception, the falcons don't kill all the problems. But these birds, like starlings, they're imprinted in their minds, in their ancient mind, that if they see that falcon form in the sky, get the hell out of there. So just by seeing a falcon or a peregrine going over the top will chase a lot of those birds away forever.
Some of you may have heard me say this, but some of you are new, but excuse me, some years ago, we went to the Sharjah Book Festival, which is, you know, one of the Emirates, and one night we were all invited out to have a dinner and the whole bit out in the desert. They had tents, they had carpets, you know, they had food, the whole bit. It was great. And we were sitting with a Swedish publisher and a Turkish publisher, and I looked over and I saw that one of the displays for everybody's entertainment was in fact a falconer. he had on the big, you know, leather thing, and he had the bird and all. And so I thought, okay, CJ, I'm gonna give this one a shot. And so I did. I went over, and he was really nice, and you know, I got to put on the gauntlet and hold up the bird and the whole bit. And it was really exciting to watch that bird fly, but even more exciting that he came back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one thing with falconry is that no one's ever guaranteed that that bird is going to come back.
Right.
They can just fly away, and sometimes falconers will spend years, not so much training as working with a falcon, and then it'll fly away. And then there's sometimes where 2 or 3 years later, the bird will show up again. And so it's really kind of a mystical, interesting thing.
Birds in the Wild, did anybody read the obituary today of Flacco the Owl? Do you know who I mean? He's an owl. Somebody cut his enclosure.
Yeah.
At the Bronx, I think it was the Bronx Zoo. Anyway, he was able to escape the zoo, and he's been on his own in the wild for a year in New York City. But he apparently crashed into a building. Owls aren't really meant to live in urban canyons, and died. And the Times wrote a huge obituary to Flacco the Owl. He had, you know, camp people really followed him, the idea of a, because they're predators.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a predatory bird on the loose in New York City was an exciting thing. And it's sad that he died, but apparently he never wanted to go home, because he could have, and they tried to catch him, and he resisted.
Right. You know, that's an interesting little sidebar to that, is that falconers kind of look down on owls. They like other kinds of falcons. They think owls are stupid. But people love owls, so therefore.
They have great faces.
They have great faces because their eyes are in the front, so they look more human.
Yep. There are owl sanctuaries. I've been to one in Wales and one up on the Columbia River. Oh, you're right, they do have a sort of a tug. So, Sheridan, Mary Beth, who else in the family is involved in this?
It's primarily Mary Beth and Sheridan
okay.
in this one. The other two girls are largely absent. Although Nate Romanowski certainly plays a role, as well as his wife Liv and their new little girl named Kestrel, which is the smallest of all the falcons. That's,
right.
that's the name there. And they're all involved in this book. It's hard not to give things away.
Yes.
So that I'll just say.
Let's leave it at that.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely so. So in your books, from time to time, bad people return. So in this book, you do bring back one of the baddest of all the people you've ever written about. So why don't you start by reminding us who he was in the book that he first showed up in?
Sure, Dallas Cates, ex-rodeo champion, comes from the Cates family outside of Saddle Spring. Over several books, he's involved. He's a bad guy.
But his mother is worse.
His mother is even worse, and he's got a brother, two brothers, and a sister-in-law, and they're all bad. And over the course of many books, the entire family is wiped out through different circumstances. So Dallas Cates is still in prison until this book, kind of trumped up charges, because Joe Pickett and the other law enforcement want to take him off the street, wanted to, but they couldn't really pin the worst things on him. So they kind of, like I said, trumped up charges a little bit just to get him off the street and into prison in Rawlins. And it's in this book, Dallas Cates is released. And as he is released, he has six names tattooed on his skin. And that is the list of people he attributes to ruining his life, killing his family, losing his property and his reputation. And of course, Joe Pickett is one of them, and so is Nate Romanowski.
So Grizzly Bears and Dallas Cates, it can't be good, right? All things considered. One of the things you and I talked about was in the TV show that Mary Beth really kind of walked away with, she was, you and I agreed, did the actress that played her was really great.
Yes.
Has that in any way influenced how you might write the books in terms of what Mary Beth might, what role she might play?
Do the show and the characters influence the book? I would say no.
No, I just meant that, because she was almost the primary character, are you writing her larger in the books as a result?
In some books, yes.
Yeah.
And I have since the beginning. In some, she plays a very major role.
Right.
The book two, Shadows Real, is more a Mary Beth book than a Joe book. So yes, to some degree. And by the way, on the TV show, I just thought I'd mention that, you know, Joe Pickett ran 2 seasons on Paramount Plus. I don't know how many people saw it. We thought they did a really good job with it. We were happy. My wife and I were very happy with it. And the casting, and I liked working with the producers. Through a lot of complicated reasons, Paramount Plus decided not to do a season 3. So the producers are trying to find a new streaming service for it. It had to do with who originally commissioned the show, which was another channel entirely, who owned what, very complicated. But we're hoping, we're at fingers crossed, they'll find another place for it.
So it's been shot not in Wyoming, but where?
Calgary, around Canada.
Where you got to go.
I got to go, and I've got to say, they did great. I mean, it looks just like Wyoming, I bet. Except for the elk. They did CGI elk that I don't know where they thought, why they thought they looked like that. But everything else looks good.
So CJ was on set. He texted me some photos of himself in his director's chair and the whole bit.
Yes.
How much did you actually get to do?
It may sound kind of exciting, but being on the set of a TV show, the most boring thing on earth. You sit in a tent with a headset, watching a monitor, watching the actors do the same scene 27 times, and then you're done for the day. You know, but it's fun to meet them and to go out to dinner and drinks later, but the actual filming stuff is just watching people move things around and say the same stuff over and over. So
in the course of the books, Joe has tangled with other people in the agency, but also he's had a relationship with people higher up in politics in Wyoming, like the governor and so forth. So where are we standing now in terms of the governor?
Well, the ex-governor Roulon, who originally kind of used Joe as his private agent out there, is now the governor again. It is legally possible for a governor to do 2 terms in Wyoming and sit out and run again. It can't be 3 consecutive terms, but in this case, he's back.
Aha.
Yeah.
So, food for future books.
Yeah, that's right.
So, before we take questions from the audience, what about Cassie Duell? What's going on there? And if you all have not read Treasure State, I want to say it is one of CJ's absolutely best books. It's Cassie Duell, her second as a private investigator working in Montana. You did a deep dive into history. This is where the labor movement of this country really started. There is so much to learn in Treasure State, but also it's a really terrific story.
Thank you. Somebody here is from Butte, Montana, right? There she is. Yeah, so a lot of takes place around Butte, Anaconda, Bozeman area. I have a thought. I have an idea for the next Cassie Duell book.
Great.
I haven't started it yet. I'm not contractually obligated to write it, but I want to get it done and then put it out there. But it may still be 2 or 3 years away.
Well, you know, you've been a real trooper writing more than one book a year. And
yeah.
Like me, you're not as young as we were when we began this relationship. So maybe one book a year is about a reasonable number.
Well, if I do one book a year, I time it so that I'm usually, it's supposed to be turned in the fall, but
for
I usually have it done
now,
before the summer. Yeah, the next. I usually have it done before the summer begins, so that I can fish and golf, and not tell the publishers the book is done.
I love it. So, have you gotten faster as you've been writing?
I think so. Each one takes about 5 to 7 months. The ones that are the standalone of the Cassie Duell ones tend to take longer simply because I don't write them simultaneously. I don't go back and forth. I have to stop the book and then do the Joe Pickett novel and then go take longer overall.
So to do a book that frequently, do you have sort of a laboratory of ideas, instigating incidents, whatever it is? Because, you know, you can't actually write a book if you don't have anything to say.
That's right. No, I'm always just kind of paying attention to what's going on, you know, picking up storylines here and there, and some storyline, just for an example, the book The Highway, that's the book where Cassie Duell is first introduced, and that's about a serial killer truck driver. Really creepy book. And that came about because I read a story about the FBI creating a, what they call a highway serial killer task force, because they thought there was probably 24 drivers responsible for over, at that point, over 1,000 missing truck stop prostitutes. So that's how that started. I wanted to write that book, but it couldn't be a Joe Pickett book. That wouldn't make sense. So that's how, you know, some ideas are just not going to be a Joe Pickett story in Wyoming. They're going to be out elsewhere, and that was one of them.
But meantime, if you're working on Joe Pickett, are you like cruising the news in Wyoming or whatever? What incidents in Wyoming do you pick up that gets you started on a new novel?
It's
usually, do you have a backlog of them?
I do. It's usually a news story or something I overhear people talking about in the post office or in the grocery store, or, you know, I like to write about contemporary issues that really concern people, and then expand it into the novels. And this book is not only about the bear attacks, but also a little side adventure into called Corner Crossing, which is a resource-based, that in Wyoming there's checkerboards of public land that were established when the railroads were there. So every other mile of public land, and the corners of the public land touch, sometimes through very big private ranches. And a few years ago, because GPS systems are so good now, some hunters figured out that they could bring a little ladder and put it right on the corner and cross over the ladder and just keep on public land deep into the heart of someone's private ranch. And so that's been big court cases, and it's been a big deal. It's not resolved yet, but I included that in the book.
What kind of feedback do you get from your fellow Wyoming citizens about your books?
It's generally pretty positive. You know, there's, I don't get bad feedback. I'm amazed how many people read them in the state. And you know, and how all the politicians do, and because they all think they should be portrayed in the books, you know. And a lot of them are in there. You know, I do this thing where I give away. I think a lot of authors do this to fundraisers. I give away your name in a CJ Box book release, and the highest bidder for a good cause can have their name or a name they designate in there, and. Most of the politicians in Wyoming have their names in the books, but I always make them thugs. And I tell them ahead of time, you're going to be a really bad guy. And they go, oh, okay, that's great.
That's true. It was actually a great fundraiser for charity, but I remember years ago I was reading along the book by another, I won't name, and ran past the license plate on the car, came into play, and I went right past it, and then it looks very familiar, so I paused, I went back, and I thought, that's my license plate. So I wrote to the author, and they said, well, I didn't think you'd mind. You know, it was a different state, same number, but yeah. You know, different state. So, and that actually can be a real problem in terms of if an author like makes up a phone number, and people think it's real. And it is turns out to be a real number, which it probably will be, because there are only so many. It's you know, that kind of thing is easy to happen.
It is, and it often always needs names. Always need new characters. You know, and that's a good way to get them. We started this conversation. I talked about Neil Nyman, the editor, who also edits John Sanford. And John Sanford has a character. He was in a lot of books named. If you've read his book, a fellow cop named Dale Capslock. And I mentioned to my editor, Neil, I said, I know where he got that name. He looked at his keyboard, delete caps lock. And Neil did never knew that. And he said, oh my God, all these years, oh.
So, it actually is something that comes up quite a lot. We have these discussions. People often ask about naming, and you can't really reasonably give somebody a name that would almost never be encountered in Wyoming, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, there's a large Finnish population in Minnesota, but probably it's pretty thin in Wyoming.
It is pretty thin.
So you'd have to make up your mind, or at least pay attention. You wouldn't want to. Give somebody a name that doesn't resonate with the state and the story.
Right, and sometimes the people who win these names in the book have such outlandish names, and I'm almost embarrassed to put them in the book because they sound fake. You know, a few books ago, there was an FBI agent named Sunny Magazine. Like, come on. That was her name, yeah. You know?
Blame her parents.
Yeah.
Right. Right, indeed. One other thing I wanted to mention before we open it up to questions. You might have noticed there's a little book out in the front, and it's a profile that CJ wrote, and I thought there were a few paperback copies left as we came in.
There
so
are.
Tell us a little bit about the profile.
Sure. Fellow bookseller and publisher Otto Penzler is at the Mysterious Bookshop in New York, and he, over the years, has asked authors to do little profiles
of their characters,
their main characters. And he's been asking me to do Joe Pickett for years and years, and I've been putting him off. Then finally figured out a way I could kind of do it that I was comfortable with. And I just saw it for the first time here. I've not yet gotten a copy. And in it, Sheridan is interviewing her dad about different things. So you can learn a lot more about Joe Pickett and his upbringing and Sheridan's interest in him.
So, I mean, it's not supposed to be an investigation.
No.
It's supposed to be just a little amplification of
right.
Joe's character, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think it's a really interesting idea. So if you like that, I think we still have a few copies left. So anything else you'd like to say, or should we open up to questions?
Happy to answer questions.
All right, it's up to you to call on them.
Yes, sir. Sure, good question. I do that with each book. I do a pretty comprehensive outline before I even begin it with all the characters that are going to be in it. These things always change, but that's how I started out. What characters are going to be in it, what they're like, what they do, and then the reoccurring characters. How old are they all now? Where were they in the last book? And that's how I start to try to keep that continuity. I have assistants from all three of my daughters and my wife, when they read the manuscript, they all say, you had this, you know, the taxidermy shop was on Main Street, now you say it's on First Street, which is a kind of thing. But there's a guy in Denver who's an ex-engineer, and on his own, which astonishes me, has built a database of every single character name in every single book. And each year he updates it with the current book. And it's now a searchable database, and I go back to it all the time. Yeah. When was this person introduced? How many books was he in? What were they doing? So that's really helpful. And his wife thinks he's nuts, and I kind of do too, but it's really helpful. Yes, sir. Right.
We contributed more to the combination of Joe Pickett and Castillo in the
It's possible. I just sort of set the stage for something like that happening without having a real end game in mind. I thought it would be fun for readers of both series to suddenly realize who Kathy Newell's intern was. There's this little cowgirl from Wyoming, and we know it's April. And that was fun to do that little crossover. They made both, I've got two different publishers, who made both a little nervous. What's he up to? And I don't know what I'm up to, other than I thought it would be interesting. Yes? Sure. I kicked around the idea of Missy versus a grizzly bear. I wasn't sure who would win. So she's not in this book. So I don't think that far ahead. I don't have any game on that. And as far as the pistol thing goes, I like the idea of Joe Pickett just thinking he never probably will ever have to draw his gun in anger again. So, you know, he's adequate with it, but he doesn't spend a lot of time with it. A few years ago, I was doing research for a book, and I went to Montana, and I was going to do ride-alongs with the Sheriff's Department in Helena, Montana. And when I landed there, the first thing they did was they took me to their range, their gun range, and you know, started showing me how to properly fire all these guns. And I said, guys, I can shoot. It's Joe Pickett who can't shoot. You don't need to do this. Yes, in the, yeah, the green guy. What was that?
Do you dislike sheriffs as much as you keep killing boyfriends or injuring?
You keep killing
sheriffs. Oh, yeah, well, in this book, no, I like her. That's why I want to keep her pure. Exactly the opposite. Yes, sir. Oh, when I depart from the outline, sometimes I really welcome it. There have been, I think, for example, there's something that happens halfway in the middle of the book, The Highway, that I was not planning on at all when I started the book. It just all of a sudden hit me. What if I did this? And I think it made it a better book, because it's totally unexpected. And some readers were really angry with me about that. But I thought it was a really good twist. Well, sorry. So sometimes, I just welcome them sometimes, you know. And there have been a couple occasions where I've gone off in a direction and thought, nah, reel it back. That's, you know, we don't want to go do that necessarily. But because I pre-plan them, I kind of know what I'm going to write every day. I don't just sit there and make up a news, you know, stare at the screen and think, what's going to happen today? There are. Some of these plots are so interconnected that by going off in a direction, it kind of unravels it all.
I'm glad you asked that, because you know, I sometimes wonder if readers think that the book they get is the only version that the author, you know, wrote, but that's not true. Books go through a lot of evolution, and then they go through an editing process, and you know, oftentimes, I remember a wonderful author named Bob Eversus, who we haven't heard from in, gosh, after it all, has been forever. But he once said a thing that I often quote, which I think is totally true. What he said was that every book exists in three forms. First, there's the form in the author's head that's absolutely perfect because he hasn't written it yet or he's only writing it, and so it's like the platonic ideal of the book. Then there is the book that the author actually writes and is published, which is rarely exactly like the first book. But most importantly, the third version of the book is the one that each of you reads, because each of you reads a book differently. You bring your own experiences, your own likes and dislikes, whatever it is, to the book. And that's what makes talking about books, I think, really interesting, mm-hmm. you know, is that although there are common plot threads that we can't disagree on, how that's interpreted. I mean, are you on the grisly side, or are you on, you know, the other side? You know, are you pro-missy, or you're anti-missy? Mm-hmm. Whatever it might be. And so, you know, I think that's one of the things that makes it so much fun to get together and talk about books, is this kind of different perspectives.
It is. Yeah, I agree. Yes? I do both, really. Sometimes when I have, because I often do, you know, several plots, several narratives in a book from different perspectives, and sometimes I will write them all connected and then chop them up for different chapters. But generally, I write from page one to the end without doing that. Generally. Yes, Gary. Yes, you can.
I've read that to counter writer's block, Aaron Sorkin will take like 5 showers a day. Do you have to sort of go to reliable method?
Yes, what I have learned, it's not necessarily a method, what I've learned is just to walk away and go do something else. And whether it's in my sleep or when I'm fishing or something, all of a sudden that answer will come. If I sit there and try to concentrate on it, it will not. So I just walk away and it'll hit me. And sometimes it hits me while my wife is talking to me and she sees a blank look on my face and says, "You've not heard a word I've said, have you?" And I'm like, "No, but I just figured out how to do this." And that's how it comes sometimes. Yes, sir. Yes.
I'm a personal friend of Wayne Patterson.
Oh, really?
I made a Bob on it, you know, on the show. And I talked to you.
Yeah, I talked to him this morning.
I heard that on the podcast. I appropriated that to my own office. I'm going to do that in my
office. Oh, good. Make sure that they die horrible deaths. Judge Hewitt. Oh, he's very, I'm not going to tell you. You've got to read the book. But yeah, he's pretty prominent in this one. Yeah, I can't wait till he reads that. Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, good. Thank you.
There's a gentleman in a blue shirt there.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for coming.
Sure, my pleasure.
My question is actually a lot of curious thinking, but also there are thousands of models across the country. And my language about the state is
few, yeah.
Definitely.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Oh, yeah. Okay, I'll give you a little background. Audiobooks are one of the fastest growing parts of publishing these days. And I've been lucky enough since the very first book to have one narrator throughout 24 years of doing Joe Pickett book. And his name is David Chandler. And I've heard lots of listeners, readers, who like him and like the way he does books. And I met the publisher last year, and I said, you know, I've never met David Chandler. They were the one who selected him. The audio companies sometimes involve the author, but in this case of the new guy, I wouldn't have known anyway, you know, who to choose. But so we arranged for him to come to my house, and we did some interviews and just talking, sitting around talking. And it was quiet. It was really kind of fascinating to me to talk to somebody who, in effect, you know, had been as involved in every book from a different perspective as I was. And I asked him a lot of questions and things I'd always wondered. I said, you know, when a character is introduced and you give them a certain voice, do you regret that voice you gave them 20 books later when they're still in there? Or are you happy with that? And those kind of questions. It was a lot of fun, and those were all videos that were shot and put on Instagram and Facebook. So thanks. Hope he stays around, you know.
Yeah.
He's older than I am, so you never know. Yes?
We expect a pickup car.
Box and Janet Ivanovich somehow or other would decimate the automobile industry.
That's right.
I know, it's so funny. Your books are so different, yet they have that common thread.
Yes, a lot of wrecked cars.
Right? Indeed. Anyone else? Way over there.
In the back there.
And then over here.
Similar book series. Barbara could answer that one too. I'd say, I would say certainly the John Sanford Prey series. I think William Kent Kruger.
Certainly Kent Kruger. Michael McGarity, who writes about New Mexico, and all of the books take place within New Mexico. And Stephen Havel, who also sits. Michael is more in the center or north of New Mexico. Stephen Havel's books are all set in the Budia. But again, law enforcement and contained here. An author named Archer Mayer, who did not do a new book this year, but his book's about Vermont, where he has progressed through a sort of career in law enforcement, are absolutely fabulous. I collect them myself because I'm so fond of them. So it's most of the time, it's marrying the character to a landscape that really, you know, whether it's Spencer in Boston, for example, you know, you tend to think that way. Yes, sir?
I was going to say Paul Warren, too. You asked for Jane Warren and Maine.
Paul will be here, I'm happy to say, on Sunday, June 23rd.
Good.
Right, I just talked to him about it. Linda Castillo, who writes a wonderful series about a woman police chief in Amish country in Ohio. And one of the great things about it is you get to learn, you know, it's not just following the investigation, but you get to learn about a particular culture, a particular landscape. Let's not forget Tony Hillerman, you know, the and Ann Hillerman is doing an interesting job continuing those. She'll be here on Sunday, July 21st. I might be the only person you know who can tell you what day of the week a date falls on, because we are actually booked into September then. It's interesting how, you know, when you started, it wasn't nearly this accelerated, but to a great degree, publishing has become about performance. You know, one reason CJ, you know, aside from his great books and all the rest of it, is that you are a good performer.
Oh.
You're fun to come, isn't he?
Thanks.
I mean, he's funny.
Thank you. Thank you, Barbara.
So personality has a lot to do with how we read a book, right? If you don't like the author, you tend to read a book negatively, and if you like the author, you know, you bond to the book and the characters. I think it's really important. Yeah, I love meeting new authors. We have made a specialty for 34 years now. I was shocked when you said 24 years. Boy, I can't believe I was 10 years into this when you published Open Season. Wow.
Yeah, 2001.
Okay, so it really was. Anyway, what's really fun is to meet new voices and speculate. I mean, when Open Season published, there were like you and me. And, you know, over time, we're going to be hosting Don Winslow's final book and final book tour on April 8th. And, you know, we've been with Don for all of his books but the first one. It's wonderful to, for you as a reader, to meet a new author and then watch what happens, you know, watch them develop and decide if you like their voices and so forth. It's been a real joy doing this over the years.
Yes.
Yes.
You had a question?
There was a lady over here.
He's 51. You know, because not every book takes place a year after the last one. I actually had to figure this out a few years ago. All of a sudden, I realized I'm starting one. I thought, oh my God, I don't know how old he is. So I went back to the very first book. There's one mention that he was 34 at the time. And then I kind of went by book, whether they were a year apart, a few months apart, back to back, came up with the fact that he was at that point 50, and now 51. And so because they're not all annual, it could go for a long time. I feel, I don't want to write about, people don't want to read about an 80-year-old game warden in the field. So it won't be a natural time when it doesn't make sense. But that's a ways off.
Watch the age comment.
Well, watch the age comment. Okay.
Right, so you probably have noticed that in crime fiction in particular, dogs live forever. I mean, hardly any dog, you know, dies at its allotted time.
I've killed a few.
Well, no, but I mean, if the dog is kind of a character, the dog tends to oftentimes can outlive the rest of the cast. That's great. Right, so one more. There we are. Yes, sir.
So your last book, you talked about going to Baker City. You're pretty active in your drawings today, and you went to Portland. Did you know you were going to Baker City and to Portland? Did you get that, or did you come sitting in that area and said this would be great for the book?
No, I plotted it out. I thought it would be great for the book. And for me, you know, I never write about a real location without having been there, or going there. Even though I may not go on and on in the description, the location gets so set in my mind that I feel like I can do that. So I always find it important. I never like go to Google Maps for a location. I go to the place. So thank you.
You bet. Anybody else? Yeah.
Sure, my pleasure. Sure.
However, I don't remember if it was on Netflix or other streaming services. It was a real show.
Paramount Plus.
She actually included it.
Good. Another TV show? No. Not to say it wouldn't happen, but you know, I've written two series, Cassie Duhuel and Joe Pickett. Both of them have been TV shows, so I'm not sure what another series would be. What's that?
She's not giving up on Cody Hoyt.
Oh, Cody Hoyt, well.
It could be a ghost series, right? Back from the Dead.
That would be a very short series in one episode.
So if you all have asked all your questions, I would like to ask you a question because we've been doing this forever. And we just sort of picked arbitrary times to start our events. And part of the reason that we do ours at 7 is because of the driving conditions in Phoenix. You can't hop on a train and, you know, the traffic at rush hour is not very wonderful to navigate. So we've been doing 7 for years. But this tonight, we're here at 6. So was that a hardship? You could just, you know, I'll ask for a show of hands. How many people found that 6 was just a bit too early? Not so many. Okay. So does that mean that, you know, given the author, you'll come out regardless of the conditions, the time and all of it? Well, let me ask this. How many people find that 7 is inconvenient? Okay.
Yeah. Pretty even.
Yeah, it is. It really has to do more with the traffic situation than anything else. If people work, it can be very hard to drive a distance to get
sure.
over here. You know. So, are you all aware that we stream our programs? Does everybody here know that you can go to poisonpen.com and you can click on either Facebook or Google and you can watch almost all the programs that we do? So, if you find it inconvenient, if you'd rather stay home in your jammies, if it's raining, as long as the author can get here, the great thing about streaming is that the weather back in the day, because of, you know, the hazardous driving conditions, so if we had a bad night or a storm or something, nobody would show up, and it would be disastrous. But the great thing about streaming, as long as the author can get to the bookstore, everything else is fine. You know, we have our conversations, so I think of us as sort of, you know, Netflix for books is what it comes down to. But I did want to mention that to you since I'm here. That is an option. So we might from time to time, maybe we should cut it in half, Patrick, and start at 6:30 some of the time, make it a little bit earlier. Earlier for the staff too, I might add. We won't have to stay out so late. So, and you know, it's just it's never been a good way to ask.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a sample population. So let's thank CJ for coming to see us.
Thank you. And we'd like to say, if you didn't know Barbara or the Poison Pen, I mean, it is the best mystery bookstore in the country. Right here, you guys have it, and I hope you appreciate it.
hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.